The headlines. At least one settler has been killed in a shooting attack, which Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says is a response to Israeli crimes. South Korean sources say Iranian assets frozen due to U.S. sanctions are getting prepared to be transferred to Iran. Also coming up, German police arrest two American soldiers over the death of a young man at a fun fair in the west of the country.
Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us.
An Israeli settler has been killed and one critically injured in a shooting near the city of Hebron or Al-Khalil, south of the occupied West Bank. Israeli media say Palestinians in a passing vehicle carried out the shooting. The regime forces have cordoned off the area and launched a manhunt for the perpetrators. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has hailed the shooting as a response to Israel's ongoing assaults on Palestinians. The movement says the shooting also marks the 54th anniversary of the arson attack on Al-Aqsa Mosque, which Palestinians blame on Israel. The Israeli military has demolished four Palestinian homes in a village in the eastern occupied West Bank. Regime forces broke into the village near the city of Jericho, also known as Ariha, this morning. They sealed off the area before proceeding with the demolition. The regime's military has also notified five other homeowners that their homes will be torn down. Israel regularly raises Palestinian structures under the pretext of lacking construction permits. The U.S. says the regime demolished 54 Palestinian structures across the West Bank only in the month of July. Iran's assets blocked in South Korea due to U.S. sanctions have been reportedly transferred to Switzerland's central bank for exchange and then transferred to Iran. South Korea's official news agency Yonhap says the Swiss bank will convert the $6 billion fund into euros in the next 5 weeks, and the sums will be transferred to Iran. South Korea's finance ministry has refrained from commenting on the issue. Last week, Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi also said the released assets will be used to enhance the country's domestic production. Earlier, we were joined by political analyst Tim Anderson. He said South Korea's move to freeze Iran's assets was a step taken under the pressure of the U.S.
There's a very strange debate going on in the U.S. that suggesting that the Biden administration is somehow giving Iran money, that you know that it wasn't Iran's to start with, but as I understand it, it's Iran's money from sale of oil to Korea. Now, the interesting thing is how Korea's been involved in this. Korea, of course, is a very dependent state, which militarily occupied by the U.S. for more than 70 years, and which pretty much does what it's told. I mean, the Europeans do the same sort of thing, really, too. But Korea's in a difficult situation because it's carried out a transaction. It hasn't paid for presumably the oil that Iran sent it. And now you have most of the oil exporters in the world under some sort of blockade, economic blockade by the US. In other words, there's a generalized situation in the world now where oil importers like South Korea and many other countries, on the one hand, under pressure from the US to do what the US tells them, on the other hand, they're damaging their own credit ratings and their capacity to buy things for their own populations if they refuse to pay for the goods that they're receiving, you know. So this is creating a serious problem because these US so-called sanctions, which are really unilateral coercive measures, are making trade very difficult for everyone, not just the people that they're trying to attack, but also third parties, if you like South Korea.
The Iranian Parliament Speaker Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf meets his Algerian counterpart Ibrahim Bouaghi in Tehran. In a press conference after the meeting, Ghalibaf said both countries reiterated the need for developing bilateral, regional, and international cooperation. He also said an economic commission between the two nations will be launched soon. The speaker also expressed Tehran's willingness to cooperate with Algiers to counter the repeated desecrations of the Holy Quran in Europe. Bouaghi, for his part, said his country looks forward to closer cooperation with Iran. The Iraqi government has ordered the formation of a committee to follow up on the U.S. assassination of the top Iranian and Iraqi commanders back in January of 2020. An Iraqi lawmaker says Prime Minister Mohammad Ashia al-Sudani has called for a quadrilateral committee comprised of representatives from Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. Faleh al-Khazali said the U.S. was the main protagonist behind the assassination of Iran's Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and the deputy commander of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Forces, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandas. The two anti-terror icons and some of their companions were killed in a U.S. drone strike outside of Baghdad International Airport on a direct order from then-American President Donald Trump. The German police say that they have arrested two U.S. soldiers over the death of a young local in the western town of Wittlich. The police say the victim was a 28-year-old man who was stabbed just outside of his home after a fight. According to the police, the case against the suspects has been established. The police also says the case and the detainees have been handed over to U.S. authorities, according to the NATO statute. Some 35,000 U.S. troops are stationed in Germany as part of security agreements that go back to the World War II occupation of the country by Allied forces. Italians are grappling with record-high fuel prices. This month alone, the cost of petrol reached a new record high for the 17th straight day. Max Giavilli has sent us this report from Rome, where he tells us how the price rise is affecting Italians' living conditions.
In Italy, August is the time when millions of people take their annual holidays. The large majority of the Italians travel to their favorite destinations with their cars. But this summer, Italians are grappling with record high fuel prices that may affect their programs, with the cost of petrol reaching a new record high for the 17th consecutive day this month. According to official data, the price of fuel with standard quality reached 2.019 euros per litre on the highways earlier this week. Petrol price at some service stations has even reached 2.7 euros per litre. The last time when prices were so high was in July 2022, following the start of the war in Ukraine. The country's industry minister, Adolfo Urso, has blamed the rise in the prices of petrol and diesel to policies adopted by the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, also known as OPEC. The EU has imposed massive and unprecedented sanctions on Russia, as well as a ban on Russian oil imports over the war in Ukraine. This measure has severely affected the few refineries located in Italy. Fuel prices affect levels of consumer confidence. According to Italy's Bureau of Statistics, Istat, the country's economic morale plunged sharply in July.
This thing is slipping out of our government's control. Everything costs 30 to 40% more. At this pace, we won't be able to go anywhere in summertime.
Italy's main farmers association, Coldiretti, has warned that in a country like Italy, where almost 90% of the goods travel by road to reach the shelves, the increase in fuel prices will result in sharp spikes, over 30%, in the cost of fruit and vegetables. Max Civili, Rome.
The North Korean leader has overseen a test of strategic cruise missiles aboard a warship, vowing to reinforce the country's navy. While Kim Jong-un was on board the vessel, he pledged to strengthen the naval forces with improved combat efficiency and full modern means. He said the measures would include the construction of powerful warships. He said the Navy should keep constant mobility and steadily increase its capability for actual war so that they can actively carry out the combat missions under any circumstances. Kim's visit came as South Korea and the U.S. kicked off annual joint military drills, which Pyongyang sees as a rehearsal for war. Pakistani authorities have arrested two key opposition leaders in connection with an investigation into a diplomatic cipher. Detained former Premier Imran Khan claims that it contained a threat from the U.S. to oust him from power. Our correspondent from Islamabad, Nasser Kazmi, has more.
The vice chairman of Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf Party, Shah Mahmood Qureshi, and party's former secretary general, Asad Umar, have been arrested by the authorities after being accused of misusing a secret official document. Under the country's Official Secrets Act, on disclosing the contents of a diplomatic cipher for political gains, the counter-terrorism wing of Pakistan's Federal Investigation Agency registered a case against the two former federal ministers, along with ex-premier Imran Khan. Khan was sacked from power in April 2022 after he lost a no-confidence vote in parliament. Since then, he has been accusing the United States of hatching a conspiracy with the help of his political opponents and the military to remove him from power through a diplomatic cipher. Khan is currently serving 3-year jail sentence after a court found him guilty in a corruption case earlier this month. He has also been barred from taking part in politics for 5 years. Just moments before his arrest late on Saturday, the former Pakistani foreign minister Qureshi condemned what he called a widening crackdown on his party by the interim government. He said that his party will knock on the door of the country's top court to ensure that the elections be held on time in a free and fair manner.
It was unfortunate that PTI leaders were being arrested and then released after an announcement that they want to part ways with PTI. The caretaker Prime Minister has said that he will ensure transparent elections. I would ask him how he will do so in such an environment. I would request the Chief Justice of Pakistan and the Election Commission to take notice and ensure a level playing field for PTI.
Political analysts believe that the upcoming polls would be considered as one of the most controversial elections in the history of the country in the absence of one of Pakistan's popular political parties, the PTI.
The chief of PTI, Imran Khan, is in jail. The number two of that party, the vice chairman of PTI, is also arrested in the Cypher case. So it looks that the PTI is going to be in a very disadvantageous position in the coming elections. The PTI also claims that thousands of its activists and political workers are in jail and they'll be tried in the military courts.
In the light of the possibility that the general elections may be delayed due to Election Commission of Pakistan's decision to hold new delimitations, major political parties strongly condemned ECP decision, warning that the unconstitutional postponement of elections could escalate into political instability and uncertainty.
According to the political commentators, if the current caretaker setup stretches beyond its constitutional tenure, a lingering period without an elected government could lead to military intervention in the cash-strapped country. Nasser Kazmi, Islamabad.
China has carried out military drills around Taiwan in a stern warning to Washington, following a visit by Taiwanese VP William Lai to the U.S. Chinese military officials have said that they deployed frigates, fast attack missiles, boats, fighter jets, and a number of other sophisticated weaponry as part of the drill.
The situation remains volatile around Taiwan as Chinese military has carried out joint exercises there. In a statement, the Chinese Defense Ministry said it carried out joint naval and air combat readiness patrols around the island. It said it was holding the exercises and training of naval and air forces, focusing on ship-aircraft coordination and seizing control to test the forces' actual combat capabilities. The Chinese military said the equipment deployed included destroyers, frigates and missile boats, as well as fighters, early warning and jamming aircraft that assembled in a predetermined area. Taiwan's defense ministry said it detected 42 Chinese aircraft and 8 ships involved in the drills around the island as of Saturday morning, and it had deployed ships and aircraft in response. The Chinese military said the maneuvers were a serious warning against Taiwan independent separatist forces colluding with external forces to provoke. Taiwan's government strongly condemned the drills. The Taiwanese defense ministry said it had the ability, determination, and confidence to ensure national security of Taiwan. The government's Mainland Affairs Council, which makes Taiwan's China policy, urged Beijing to stop what it called the intimidation and start talks, saying Taiwan's people were determined to defend themselves and would never succumb to threats of force. The council added Taiwan is a sovereign country and has a legitimate and legal right to conduct normal diplomatic interactions with friendly countries. The drill comes against the backdrop of a visit by Taiwan's Vice President William Lai to the United States. Lai, who was a frontrunner to become Taiwan's president in elections in January, made a number of stopovers and gave speeches while on the visit.
The military drills by China come as Washington has maintained its provocative approach toward Beijing in recent years. Such measures include the U.S. trade deal with Taiwan, American officials' diplomatic visits to the Silk Road Island, and the passage of U.S. warships through the Taiwan Strait. It is believed that Washington is supporting separatist calls in Taiwan to secure its own presence there and to ultimately contain Beijing.
This stopover of Taiwan's vice president to the U.S. comes as previous instances of such diplomatic visits have been the source of tensions between Beijing and Taipei, and subsequently China and the United States. That includes a visit by former Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi. Beijing launched joint military exercises around the island and suspended or canceled 8 official military dialogues and cooperation channels with the United States. In April this year, Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen met House Speaker Kevin McCarthy on a stopover in California. Beijing authorities blasted off some angry statements, imposed sanctions against a handful of individuals or entities involved in Tsai's trip, and sent warships and planes past Taiwan. Not to mention that several U.S. delegations, comprising of American lawmakers, have traveled to the self-ruled island and met with Taiwanese officials, drawing angry reactions from Beijing. China argues that any official exchanges with Taiwan will boost calls for independence in the self-ruled island. But apart from those diplomatic exchanges, tensions over Taiwan have been escalating ever since the United States enhanced its military buildup in the South China Sea in an effort to contain Beijing. After all, China has territorial claims over the self-ruled island and has warned against any move that jeopardizes its sovereignty and territorial integrity. But regardless of those warnings, Washington has continued with its collision course with Beijing over the issue of Taiwan. The sailing of U.S. vessels through the Taiwan Strait is just to name one. That raises the question that how would the United States react if Chinese destroyers sail through areas close to U.S. borders in the North Atlantic or the North Pacific Oceans, or anywhere near the Gulf of Mexico for that matter. Given all the tensions between Washington and Beijing, what seems to be further complicating the situation is numerous provocations on the part of the United States against China. From those diplomatic visits to sailing of warships to areas close to Taiwan, all seems to be preparing the ground for full-scale confrontation between the two countries.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on June 11, 2023, in a meeting with a number of scientists, specialists, experts, and officials of Iran's nuclear industry. Sometimes false claims and coercive demands are made. Do not accept these. The organization must not give in to coercive demands. Stand by your own positions. Do what you need to do, but do not give it to what they ask you to do with coercion, and do not accept it. Sometimes they make claims that are untrue. Do not accept these claims. They say, you did such and such thing at such a time. No, do not give in to their false claims. In particular, a commitment was made last March, and based on the report I saw, this report is actually new. The other party did not fulfill those commitments, but we fulfilled ours. The other party in these commitments is the IAEA. I heard it did not fulfill its commitments. Anyway, be careful.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Another important recommendation is that the existing nuclear industry's infrastructure must not be changed. During these years, the managers, officials, and those who are active in this industry have done important work and built important infrastructures. You may want to reach agreements in some areas. That's not a problem. You can have agreements, but the infrastructures must not be changed. They must not be harmed. These are the fruits of other people's endeavors. Well, you shouted, God is the greatest, too. May God make all of you successful. Of course, we were prepared to visit the exhibition for 25 minutes. I was given such a timeline, but it took twice that time. That is, we looked at the exhibition for an hour and a half, and now we were at your service. May you be successful and assisted by God, God willing. May God grant you prosperity. O Lord, for the sake of Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, bestow your grace, favor, and protection on our dear young people, our good managers, and our valuable active people in this industry. Make all of them honorable and proud in this world and the hereafter. O Lord, make our intentions in what we say and in what we do divine intentions, and accept them from us. May God's greetings, mercy, and blessings be upon you all.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Fires in Greece, Turkey, the United States. Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has paid a two-day visit to Saudi Arabia. On Friday, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman welcomed Amir Abdollahian to the city of Jeddah. It was the first time a senior Iranian official met with the Saudi Crown Prince. In their meeting, both officials reviewed bilateral ties and explored future opportunities for cooperation between Tehran and Riyadh. They also discussed the latest international and regional developments. Amir Abdollahian reiterated Iran's determination to improve relations with the countries in the region, particularly Saudi Arabia. He said Iran and Saudi Arabia play a leading role in the region and the Muslim world. He underscored the need to boost dialogue as well as development-oriented ties as the path to success in the region. The Saudi Crown Prince, for his part, extended his own and Saudi King's greetings to Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei and President Ebrahim Raisi. Bin Salman said Saudi Arabia views the partnership with Iran as strategic. He reiterated Riyadh's invitation to the Iranian president to travel to Saudi Arabia. Before meeting Bin Salman, the top Iranian diplomat held talks with his Saudi counterpart Faisal bin Farhan in the capital Riyadh on Thursday. In a joint press conference, Amir Abdollahian said relations between the two countries are on the right track and progressing. Meanwhile, bin Farhan confirmed that the Saudi embassy in Tehran had resumed operations, which he described as another step in the development of relations between the two countries. The Saudi consulate in the northeastern city of Mashhad restarted its activities as well. At the end of his trip, the top Iranian diplomat said he found the Saudi authorities with a different approach than in the past, adding that the Saudis are willing to open a new chapter in bilateral relations. In a social media post, the Iranian foreign minister hailed the discussions as frank, beneficial, and productive. Amir Abdollahian's visit to Saudi Arabia was significant as it was the first time the top Iranian diplomat visited the kingdom since the signing of a Chinese brokered deal between Tehran and Riyadh to restore ties in March. Tehran and Riyadh severed ties in 2016 after protests broke out in Iran over Riyadh's execution of senior cleric Nimr al-Nimr. The administration of President Ebrahim Raisi has focused on the expansion of ties with neighboring and regional states, a policy which will, among other things, help Tehran benefit from the capacities of other countries. The latest thawing of relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia, two prominent countries on either sides of the Persian Gulf, is in line with this policy of President Raisi's administration. The re-establishment of diplomatic relations between the two heavyweights has become a source of concern for Israel and the West over the past months as the restoration of diplomatic relations between Tehran and Riyadh grew more serious. Arab countries have notably shifted their attitudes to Iran, demonstrating a clear interest in deepening their relations with Tehran. And at the same time, this development has raised concerns among Israel and its Western allies. Furthermore, an additional cause for their apprehension lies in the potential collaboration between Iran and Saudi Arabia in addressing the Palestinian issue, which poses a threat to Israel's political influence and propaganda efforts. Another source of worry pertains to economic and energy matters. Iran holds one of the world's largest reserves of natural gas, while Saudi Arabia is the leading oil producer. Consequently, Tehran and Riyadh could potentially play a joint role in the energy sector in the near future, the outcomes of which remain unclear for Western countries. In the realm of international affairs, embassy activities are considered customary, and having an embassy alone does not necessarily reflect the quality of relations between two nations. However, the Saudi invitation to Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi to visit the kingdom demonstrates Riyadh's keenness to enhance relations with Tehran.
Thank you.
The United Nations has warned that millions of people across Sudan are running out of food and are on the brink of famine as the situation in the war-torn northeast African country is spiraling out of control. The international body has said the ongoing armed conflict has impeded agricultural activities, causing millions of people to face acute food insecurity. Many people are also dying due to lack of healthcare. Time is running out for farmers to plant the crops that will feed them and their neighbors. The situation is spiraling out of control.
It's looting humanitarian supplies, targeting aid workers and hospitals, or blocking aid. Things we have seen throughout those 4 months may amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity.
According to the UN, the war has caused over 1 million people to cross from Sudan into neighboring countries, many already struggling with the impact of conflicts or economic crises. Those displaced within Sudan are estimated to number over 3.4 million people. Furthermore, more than 6 million people in Sudan are one step away from famine. More than 14 million children need humanitarian aid. The statement comes as 4 months of a power struggle between Sudan's army and the paramilitary rapid support forces has killed nearly 4,000 people. The conflict erupted on April 15th over tensions linked to a planned transition to civilian rule, plunging the country into violence. UN officials also say reports of sexual assaults have increased in the country.
Just to give you an idea, we've seen an increase of more than 900% in the conflict areas of gender-based violence. 900%. Those women are incredibly at risk, and we really do need the funding and the access to those areas to be able to provide services for them.
Reports from our protection and field teams in neighboring Chad, Central African Republic, Egypt, and South Sudan have also described the horrific ordeals faced by women and girls in Sudan. Shocking incidents of sexual violence, including rape, sexual assault, sexual exploitation, and physical violence, have been reported by women and girls who have fled the conflict.
Fighting in Sudan broke out back in April over a power struggle between two rival generals, Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and former deputy Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo.
Once we put on these khakis, we have no other path. We do not get startled or afraid. And even if every one of us is dead, we will not be frightened or back away.
The clashes initially broke out in Khartoum and later spread to Darfur. The roots of the crisis dates to several years ago. In 2019, a coup d'etat ousted the country's longtime ruler, Omar al-Bashir, in the context of massive civil disobedience. An interim joint civilian military unity government headed by Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok was established. However, in October 2021, the military seized power in a coup which was led by the Sudanese Armed Forces leader Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and rapid support forces led by Hamdan Dagalo. Rapid support forces evolved from so-called Janjaweed militias which fought in a conflict in the 2000s in the Darfur region. Over time, the militia grew. It was made into the RSF in 2013 and its forces were used as border guards in particular. In 2017, a law legitimizing the RSF as an independent security force was passed. There are also indications that Bashir-era loyalists in the army feared that a new political agreement would significantly harm their economic and political power. Many of these loyalists blame RSF leader Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo for turning on al-Bashir in 2019. Despite peace efforts, fighting continued unabated in the African country, with the army and the RSF trading blame over truce violations. In May, the two warring sides agreed to send negotiating teams to Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, to start talks brokered by Riyadh and Washington. At least 16 ceasefire agreements followed, with each of them collapsing.
The U.S. military has decided to send F-16 fighter planes to Ukraine from Denmark and the Netherlands as soon as the training of Ukrainian pilots is completed. A U.S. official said on Thursday Washington has assured both countries that it will expedite approval of transfer requests for F-16s to go to Ukraine when their pilots are trained. The U.S. must approve the transfer of F-16s from its allies to Ukraine. Coalition of 11 countries was due to start training Ukrainian pilots to fly fighter jets this month in Denmark.
As you know, Denmark and the Netherlands are taking the lead on training. We have, and the president has given the green light to allow and support the training to move forward, but I just don't have any further updates at this time when it comes to specific pilots being trained.
The thing is that it is a very strong weapon system. It's a very strong capability, but it's not going to be available anytime soon. President Zelensky, of course, knows that.
U.S. officials have privately said that the F-16 fighter jets would be no game changer when they arrive, given Russia's air defense systems and its air superiority, that the request would be approved. The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken sent letters to his Danish and Dutch counterparts, assuring them that the request would be approved. He said the approval of the request would allow Ukraine to take full advantage of its new capabilities as soon as the first set of pilots complete their training.
Officials in Kiev have repeatedly requested the F-16s. Some NATO states have agreed to instruct Ukrainian pilots, but it remains unclear when the first transfer could occur. U.S. President Joe Biden endorsing training programs for Ukrainian pilots on F-16s in May, but no timing for the supply of the warplanes has been declared yet. According to a recent report in the Washington Post, the initial batch of Ukrainian pilots trained on F-16 will not be ready until after the summer of 2024, with only six airmen set to complete the first round of instructions.
Flying-wise, well, technically, I mean, if you're a pilot, this is also just an airplane. But to fly a fighter jet and to transition to an F-16, which for them would mean, like, different technology, different design concepts.
Russia has repeatedly warned that the influx of Western weapons and military equipment only prolongs the conflict and increases the risk of military confrontation with NATO. Moscow has said Western powers would run, quote, colossal risks if they decided to supply the F-16. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has said that Russia would consider the aircraft a nuclear threat due to its ability to carry atomic weapons.
Yes, look, that's right. I mean, the pro-war people keep saying, look, it's up to Ukraine to decide when to negotiate. But the reality is the U.S. is funding practically 100% of this war, and the allies are providing 100% of the munitions. So at any time they could say, look, you know, enough's enough. We're not going to do this anymore. And then, of course, Ukraine would have to negotiate.
Ukraine says its troops have recaptured a village from Russian forces in the southeastern Donetsk region. Ukraine's deputy defense minister said forces have secured their position by erecting defensive lines on the outskirts of the village. There was no immediate response to the Ukrainian claim from Moscow. Separately, Russian drones inflicted damage upon grain facilities at Danube port in the southern region of Odessa. Ukraine has also launched a number of cross-border drone attacks inside of Russia. Meanwhile, NATO member Poland has held its biggest military parade since the Cold War in an event that marked victory over Soviet forces in 1920. Warsaw showcased the country's state-of-the-art weaponry as the war was raging in neighboring Ukraine. Poland's army has more than 175,000 troops, an increase from approximately 100,000 8 years ago.
There are existing risks associated with the militarization of Poland, which has become the main instrument of the United States' anti-Russian policy. Warsaw announced the intention to build, according to the Poles, the most powerful army on the continent.
Poland has also expressed concern about the movement of Wagner forces in Belarus towards the Polish border. The Polish Prime Minister has said, "We have information that more than 100 Wagner mercenaries have advanced towards the Suwalki Gap, not far from Grodno in Belarus. Grodno is located in the west of Belarus, about 15 kilometers from its border with NATO members Poland and Lithuania. The Suwalki Gap is a narrow strategic land corridor on their territory between Belarus and Russia's Baltic exclave of Kaliningrad. Poland is worried about its security with Russian ally Belarus and Ukraine on its eastern border.
Anti-French sentiment runs high in Niger as thousands of people have rallied near a French military base on the outskirts of the capital, Niamey, to call for the withdrawal of the country's forces. Protesters shouted "Down with France" and "Down with ECOWAS" as they surrounded the base. The demonstrators argue that the West African regional bloc is not independent and is being manipulated by France. ECOWAS has given the green light for a military intervention in Niger after it approved the deployment of a standby force as part of its effort to remove Niger military rulers following last month's coup and reinstate deposed pro-Western leader Mohamed Bazoum. The Ivory Coast president says heads of state of the 15-nation bloc have agreed that the operation should start as soon as possible. The president said his country will provide a maximum of 1,100 troops alongside soldiers from Nigeria and Benin. He said other member countries will join them later. France has thrown its full backing to all the conclusions of the West African leaders who met in Nigerian capital Abuja to make the necessary arrangements. The United States has also voiced support for efforts of ECOWAS on Niger.
As significantly, ECOWAS, the organization that brings together West African countries, is playing a lead role in making clear the imperative of the return to constitutional order, and we very much support ECOWAS's leadership and work on this.
The support for ECOWAS efforts come as a deadline set by the regional bloc for Bazoum to be reinstated on August 6th was ignored by Nigerian junta. The junta has moved one step further and announced a new government there. The developments in Niger come nearly 3 weeks after soldiers belonging to the country's presidential guard blockaded access to President Bazoum's residence in Niamey and arrested him. Shortly after the storming of the president's residence, the army led by General Abdurrahman Tiani took control of the country's political leadership there. The idea of a military intervention in Niger comes as many people across the West African nation are opposed to foreign meddling in their internal political affairs.
Today they're in front of our army. It's no longer that they're in front of us. That's to say, if they're thinking of attacking the military, they will first have to attack us, the people of Niger.
But unlike Nigerians, Western countries, namely France and the United States, are pushing for a military intervention there. After all, there are certain facts that lie within their interest, which a change in Nigerian political leadership can hamper all those benefits. In the case of France, the country has domination over Niger's economy. That's why Paris has been seeking a military solution to the crisis in Niger since the very first day of the outbreak of the coup there. One significant factor is Niger's vast uranium reserves. The country supplies around 5% of the world's uranium and is a leading supplier of that chemical element to the European Union. The French government is almost entirely dependent on Niger, as some 25% of Nigeria's uranium production goes to France. Using that uranium to produce electricity, Paris has become a large exporter of power that goes to countries like Germany and other European nations. The electricity export of that amount makes French huge profits, which make it hard for Paris to admit new political changes in Niger. In the case of the United States, Washington is seeing a growing tendency toward Russia among people in West African nations, including Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali, and that is why, seeing its political interests in tatters, it is pushing for a military intervention in Niger to reinstate pro-West former President Bazoum. With ECOWAS being under the direct influence of Western powers, an actual military intervention in Niger is not unthinkable, despite repeated warnings from Russia that any such move would destabilize the whole region. But apart from that, what matters most of all is that Niger belongs to Nigerians, and they are the ones who should decide their own fate. Given all the anti-Western hatred among the people of Niger and other West African nations, it seems that it is for the Western countries to stop meddling in the affairs of those nations and let people choose their own political path.
This is IRIB English Radio.
RIB English Radio, with you every single moment. Allah, Allah,
Allah, Allah. این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illallah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar. Dear brothers and sisters, you're listening to The Spring of Truth from IRIB English Radio. In this special episode, we select a short part of Imam Khomeini's will. We are proud to be the followers of a faith that has been established by the Messenger of Allah based on his decrees, and that the commander of the faithful, Ali ibn Abi Talib, this emancipated slave from all entanglement, has been commissioned to free men from all shackles of slavery.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitan rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And you are listening to Spring of Truth, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. So stay tuned with us. I am your host, Abdullah Al Musawi, an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qom. We are looking at Imam Khomeini's point of view when it comes to Ashura. Imam al-Khomeini was quoted saying, "If we weep until doomsday for Imam al-Hussein, we ourselves will benefit by it, not the Imam." A very simple statement, but it's very huge when you look at the meaning of it. Now, holding majalis for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam are in fact spiritual councils for transformation. They are centers for self-purification and refinement. When we go to the majalis of Imam al-Hussein salamullah alayhi, and when we weep for him, we benefit, not him. When I go to the majalis of Imam al-Hussein, I get to abandon guilt and disobedience when it comes to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. There are those who, when they come to the majalis, they hear something, they learn something, and their life changes upside down. And the stories in this regard, so many.
When your horse returns to Al-Camp Riderless, and your son and I emerge out sorrowful. When your horse returns to our camp riderless, and your son and I emerge out sorrowful. Why did you leave us to fend for ourselves? Hussein, Hussein, the slain martyr.
People might come to the majalis of Imam al-Hussein salamullah alayhi, and after attending, they become better people. And this is what we need. So it's not only for people who are lovers for Imam and who cry for the Imam, but it's for anyone that they can come, cleanse themselves, purify themselves throughout these majalis. Always the benefit of these majalis goes to us, because I'm the one who's listening, I'm the one who's crying, I'm the one who's trying to change. So Imam Hussein salamullah alayhi is just a mean for me to transform and to gain morals and to gain spirituality. So every majlis, according to the words of the Imam, it's in fact a refinement. It's a center for purification. That's why we go there.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Every night and every day, every
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. The British trade union movement has a deep-rooted commitment to Palestine's struggle for freedom. The UK's biggest trade unions are all affiliated to the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, and the TUC has a long-standing policy promoting Palestinian rights. But latterly, some trade union leaders have been yielding to coercion by fanatical pro-Israel pressure groups. And Zionist infiltrators are attempting to subvert trade union support for the Palestinian people. So we've invited a celebrated trade union leader to join our resident expert to discuss these Zionist tactics after this report by Latifa Abu Chakra, who's been looking at some recent examples of trade union infiltration and capitulation.
Trade unions are a new target for subversion by the Zionist movement. Recent evidence of this has been provided by the actions of Unite, one of the largest and most left-wing trade unions in the UK. In June, Unite issued a decree to ban from all its buildings the film O Jeremy Corbyn, The Big Lie. It tells the story of the sabotage, racism, and coordinated smear campaigns of the Labour right and the Israel lobby to bring down Jeremy Corbyn as Labour leader and defame the left. The move appears to have been triggered by the showing of the film at Unite's Tony Benn House in Bristol. But it first came to light in the union's South East region, where a planned showing at Unite's regional HQ in Portsmouth was cancelled by Unite's regional secretary. The union has even gone so far as to ban union branches from even making donations to support the film and its makers. Then, in July, it emerged that a book launch event had been cancelled. The book was the best-selling Weaponizing Anti-Semitism by Asa Winstanley. The meeting was again planned for Tony Benn House, the Unite building in Bristol. On this occasion, it appears that both the General Secretary and the President of the Union were personally involved. The Assistant General Secretary, Gail Cartmell, confirmed that she was acting on the express instructions of her boss, the President, Sharon Graham, which undermined claims by Graham's supporters that she was not personally involved. The email also confirmed that the union was co-opted by Zionist talking points because Cartmell referred to the propaganda line about the deep hurt caused by UK Jews by factual reporting on Zionist subversion of UK politics. Of course, Zionist subversive groups were not slow to take responsibility for the censorship carried out by the union. The so-called Campaign Against Anti-Semitism boasted on Twitter that it was behind the banning of the meeting. Perhaps more worrying is that the fact that the whispering campaign against the film and Asa Winstanley's book is being carried on in left-wing unions, both in the Unite and in the famously left-wing RMT, the Rail, Maritime and Transport Union. It turns out that a key vector of the Zionist penetration of Unite and the RMT is a little-known and cult-like left-wing group called the Alliance for Workers' Liberty. It advances discredited Tel Aviv talking points that there is a specifically left-wing anti-Semitism and that critiques of Zionism as a political ideology on the left are often a camouflage for racism against Jews. The trades union movement is under threat.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and is now a non-resident senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul's Zeyim University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch and is a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. Our guest today is the legendary trade unionist and pro-Palestine activist, Tosh MacDonald. Tosh is the former president of the Train Drivers Union, ASLEF, and helped to lead the campaign to democratise the Labour Party in an effort to embed a commitment to socialism and anti-imperialism. After the demise of the Corbyn leadership, which was followed by Sir Keir Starmer's ruthless purge of pro-Palestinian activists, Tosh resigned from the Labour Party. Tosh is renowned for his oratory, and he was an outspoken critic of the former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. One of his most famous rhetorical flourishes was when he said he hated Thatcher so much that he used to set his alarm clock an hour earlier so he could hate her for an hour longer each day. Welcome to the show. Tosh, what do you make of the attempt by Unite the Union to ban the Jeremy Corbyn film?
Well, Chris, I'm disillusioned by that, you know, and I get upset when people start trying to ban any kind of film. And I know that the trade union movement has been solid behind Jeremy Corbyn. I know that Unite was solid behind Jeremy Corbyn. and to now find that they're trying to put the block on, or allegedly trying to put the block on, Unite Buildings showing the film Jeremy Corbyn, The Big Lie, seems really concerning to me. I mean, I am a very great friend of Len McCluskey, the previous General Secretary. I know he was very supportive of Jeremy Corbyn and also very supportive of the Palestinian cause.
Yes, indeed. It is rather curious to say for Unite of all unions to be taking the position that they have on that. But, David, I mean, you were due to speak at that Bristol showing of the film, weren't you? And that's not the first time you've been stopped from speaking, is it? I mean, you know, what's going on here, do you think?
Well, there's a campaign to have anyone who would put the case for the Palestinian cause in a full-throated way to be banned and censored. And in particular, those who question whether there is such a thing as an anti-Semitism crisis in the UK, or whether there's such a thing as left-wing anti-Semitism, people who make those kinds of arguments, including me and Asa Winstanley and many others, they are people who are targets for being banned. And the problem is, of course, that what's happening is that there are left-wing people and organisations who are trying to draw this line. They're saying, well, we support Palestinian rights in the abstract, but we won't have this stuff about anti-Semitism as a fake, as a scam. And so they try and smear anyone who makes those kinds of arguments as being themselves anti-Semitic. I mean, it's a completely crazy approach, but it is people on the left who are doing this, in alliance with, of course, Zionist activists. It's not something that's really coming from the Labour right at present. It's largely coming from the left, and that's the most concerning thing about it, I think.
I know, Tosh, that you've had a number of run-ins with Zionists in trade unions, haven't you? I mean, tell us what's happened in those circumstances.
I will, Chris, and I'll try and be brief. I could probably do a full programme on some of the events that have taken place. But the first time it happened to me was I got invited to speak at a fringe at the TUC in Brighton. I think it was the day after. Do you remember when the Labour Party, Hilary Benn in particular, got up on the front bench and made a speech about bombing Syria,
indeed,
the airstrikes on Syria?
Yes, absolutely.
And he compared it to the International Brigade going out to fight in Spain. Well, the next day I was in Brighton speaking, and I made a comment on that, and I said that he's wrong to compare it, the airstrikes in Syria, to the International Brigaders. The International Brigaders weren't perpetrators of airstrikes, they were the victim of airstrikes. Yeah. I mean, just look what happened in Guernica. I spoke at Popelvel in the Ebro on the anniversary of the Battle of the Ebro. And at Popelvel, a village that's just been left as it was when it was bombed. You know, the Germans, the Nazis, they honed their skills that would come into play in the air raids in Britain. They owned it there. The International Brigaders fighting at the Ebro and places, they didn't have a chance against them. You know, the only danger that there was to the German pilots and the Italian fascist pilots that were flying there was engine failure. That was the first time when it came. It was all over the press. They said I'd compared Hilary Benn to Hitler, which I hadn't done, but this came out all over. Fortunately, I had the backing of a full trade union behind me, and they were able to protect me. The next time, which was probably the worst of all, was when I had the honour of speaking at the International Brigade Memorial Trust's event in Jubilee Gardens, this first Saturday in July every year, and I had the honour of speaking there, and Len McCluskey was the other speaker. Yeah. And I made a speech, many things mentioned in it, and I said, you know, I'm not old enough to remember the International Brigade, as I wasn't born then. And I said, different things will have internationalised people in different generations. I talked about the civil rights movement in America. I talked about the Vietnam War. Many different things would have done it. I said, for me, it was the anti-apartheid movement. That's what internationalised me when I got involved in the anti-apartheid movement against South Africa. And I said, I finished off by saying, what would be the issue internationalises young people today coming into the movement? And I said, it would be Palestine and the Israeli treatment of Palestine. Now, a guy got up and shouted about it, said something. The next thing, it was all over the media. There was letters being written in. There was an organisation called the UK Lawyers for Israel threatening to take the International Brigade Memorial Trust's charitable status away from it. There was We Believe in Israel, Luke Acos. I think they were asking everybody and the families to write to us, left, trying to get them to take me out of my position. They obviously didn't understand. Yeah.